This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 22nd of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 294 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show today, witches and old women. We meet the curator of a new show here in London showing images from Goya reunited after years apart.
Also ahead, it's a 450th birthday present like no other. We check the progress of Globe to Globe Hamlet, that magnificent two-year world tour of Shakespeare's famous play as it nears its midpoint.
And later in the show, one will catalogue the uses and abuses of the English language with writer and columnist Oliver Cam.
All that, plus I look ahead to the stories sure to set the news agenda in the week ahead with our very own Tom Edwards. That'll be the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. And here we are again, Andrew.
Reunited, and it feels so good.
we've had some slight teething problems, haven't we, getting the Monocle Weekly on the air today? Not on the air, physically. Not physically getting here ourselves, although...
we have a new technical system in the offing. In the studio rather.
Has it got like a cool acronym? Is it like the computer in like 2001 A Space Odyssey? Is it called HAL or is it called Betty or is it called something?
Nerd, I think.
it's the digital integration something, isn't it? I know is it's called DIC.
Okay.
But other than that, I don't know what it stands for.
We shouldn't be harsh. It's hard learning these new things.
It is, exactly.
Good show ahead. I'm looking forward to speaking to somebody about the English language. Are you a pedant?
I am a bit of a pedant.
Me too.
I think, yeah. It's one of those things, it's our job, isn't it? It's our universe. We've got to be able to, and you've got to be able to use it. You've got to know how to use it right to use it wrong stylishly.
I agree. I'm looking forward to speaking to Mr. Cam because I know that his book is all about kind of actually, do we really need those rules? So we should look forward to putting him to the test in a little while.
Put him to the test. And I'm also kind of looking forward to getting our Goya expert in as well. I think that's going to be kind of a good, if slightly macabre, show.
Okay. Well, let's not wait. should we get the doors a flicking?
Talking of the weird and wonderful, should we get Tom Edwards out of his news cupboard?
Yeah, let's get him out.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
Here he is.
Thank you, my dear friends.
Okay.
Straight from lunch with a little bit of beef gravy on his chin.
He comes to do the news look ahead every Sunday. I haven't literally got beef gravy. I think that paints a...
Although I did picture. Once work with somebody who had a very big beard, wasn't the most hygienic person, and you did see bits of food off and after.
Really?
In beard.
Like Mr. Twit.
In the beard.
The twits, yeah. That's really unpleasant.
Especially when they try to kiss you. Actually, that's the worst kiss I've ever had, actually. I was at the theatre once and someone kissed me on the lip. And as they pulled away... Yeah, on the lip. A polite kiss. But as they pulled away, a bit of half-chewed crisp stayed on my... stayed on my lip.
That is literally the worst thing I've ever heard.
I went, salt and vinegar.
Let's do the news look ahead with Tom Edwards. Hi, Tom.
Hi. This is a clean-shaven international personality.
Yep.
The Dalai Lama. You know, it's the 75th anniversary of his enthronement today.
How old was he when he was enthroned?
He was, I think, only four.
Right.
Isn't that extraordinary? 75 years. And there's only been 14 going all the way back to, I think it's like the 13th century or something.
Wow. It's obviously fairly stress-free job then.
Well, so,
but
maybe
you start early.
Counterintuitively, but Tenzin Gyatso...
You'll grow into that throne.
22nd February 1940, yeah. It was the first month of Iron Dragon Year. He's the longest-lived incumbent of that. I just thought that was rather interesting. There's not really anything to say about
that.
That's
like
today.
That.
It's just to mark it. You know, he's kind of a.
So it's his coronation. This is like his jubilee. This is his coronation day.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think the Dalai Lama's that into sort of marking thing. You know, he's not very self-referential.
Where are my presents?
Imagine he's making an absolute scene. Yeah. 75 years, pretty extraordinary. He's often suggested that he could be the last at times. Interesting.
How are they chosen, the Dalai Lama?
Oh, it's it's very sort of complicated. It needs to be approved by all of the, like a certain group, select group, I think, of monks. And it's.
Do you like Kung Fu Panda?
It basically is that. Okay. So that's modeled on it. It's Oscars night tonight. I mean, I don't like chasing celebrity stories. We're not like the E Channel. Who'll be the big winners? I don't know. It's happening later.
Do you want to tell the Kung Fu Panda story now?
No.
I think we've lost Rob in a Kung Fu Panda reverie.
No, the London School of Economics here in London, they did a marvellous thing where somebody in their IT department, who's obviously an idiot, put in a test name for all students coming from China to London School of Economics. So students in China got letters addressed to Dear Mr. and Mrs. Kung Fu Panda. Which wasn't one of their finest moments.
Not their finest moments.
Great. Anyway, sorry, we interrupt you. Back to the news.
Well, no, finest moment. I mean, Oscar night tonight. Who's going to win? Is it going to be? I always suspect that Hollywood very much likes films about films. You know, it's quite inward looking. Yeah. So you've got a movie like Birdman. I think that could win. Michael Keaton might well win. That's my hunch. But we'll find out within a few short.
I loved Birdman.
You did love that, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I think actually best actors between Eddie Redmayne and Michael Keaton. He'd be a plucky Brit to pluck it.
The plucky Brit.
I think it's between those two actually for best actor. Yeah. Best movie, I think, would be Boyhood. Actually, again, I think maybe if Keaton wins Birdman, wins for Birdman, and they'll give best movie to Boyhood. I think that's kind of
the way it's going
to
go. We'll find out.
We shall see. We did a culture show last week, which has obviously just gone off Monocle Airways. We used Grand Budapest Hotel as the prism through which we looked at the Oscar nominations. But we looked at all of the things that you don't hear on the front page of the newspaper. So we looked at set designers, editors, all these interesting jobs. So check that out.
But the nature of the internet is not forgotten, and it's not gone, Rob. It's just there at monocle.com on iTunes or SoundCloud. People can go and listen to your show. The Culture Show with Robert Bound.
It's a plug. Let's go
listen to listen to it now. Listen to the weekly now, and then maybe later on.
Later on, after the weekly. Yeah. You can celebrate if you've won big in the Oscars, because I know we have a lot of the big shots like to tune into this show, with the Habanos Festival in Havana in Cuba. Starts tomorrow, runs all week. Cigar smokers from all around the world, Rob and Andrew, attend. You go to the plantations, the factories, there's new products. Don't know what they are, I'm assuming. Cigars,
Or cutters,
and there's
paraphernalia.
There's an award
or
ceremony.
Suits made from tobacco leaves.
It's all at the Karl Marx Theatre. But I think these are the kind of cultural events in Cuba which will begin to change imperceptibly at first, and then quite decisively over the next 2-3 years, and then over 10 over a generation or whatever. And so I think if people can get the chance to sample these things now, before it's all. Golf courses and whatnot.
Go and enjoy some good old 1950s style communism. It's a laugh.
I like Cuba, and I mean, I really like.
I think I sense that you're unmoved by that.
No, I'm.
Do you not
no,
think
no,
there's
no.
a risk that something quite profound could change and be lost almost? A lot of it will be positive.
I agree, but I think would you have said to people in like East Germany, oh, don't change, it's so nice running around in tramp cars.
Well, yeah, but isn't that because that was just one part of a country, whereas it's all of Cuba? I don't know. I think there's something a bit sad about it.
Okay,
I know what you mean. I think if they're clever, they can. Because I went to the Cuba Biennial a couple of years ago. I think weirdly it's biennial that come together when they have the money, so it's not actually every 2 years. So I think it was quite good. I think they're clever. They can steward their cultural assets. Yeah. For example, I think that's going to be something really big. Mm. But talking about the golf courses is quite interesting. Where they have their art school that used to be the clubhouse for the golf course where Castro and Che Guevara used to play golf, and then they stopped playing golf and turned it into something else because they thought it wasn't good to be papped playing golf when you were supposed to be a communist and looking a little bit louche on the 19th
and finally
well, how about this Friday, something a bit different.
I tell you, if you mention the Queen, he's going to say, oh, it's funny, I had a tea with the Queen.
No.
Well, me?
Yeah.
This is an event. This is an event that Rob will have had no prior experience in. I'm fairly certain. On Friday, it's the 28th annual Texas Cowboy Poetry Gathering.
What is that?
It's pretty self-explanatory.
Texas Cowboys. So it's Texas and Cowboys.
Cowboy poets.
Shall I compare
musicians.
Thee to Hi-Ho Silver?
Yeah, they share their act. They're working cowboys and cowgirls, as well as ranchers and ranch hands. They're allowed to be in amongst it.
Okay. Thinking of words that rhyme with stallion.
It's all about the words and music of the working cowboy.
That sounds great.
10 concurrent sessions are held at various locations on the campus of Ross State University in Alpine, Texas. I think that sounds like a laugh riot.
Yeah, yeah. Lasso, so, that'd be another rhyming word. That's quite good, isn't it? Lasso,
yeah, lasso.
Shoe.
God, I feel one of your songs is coming on, Andrew.
They perform for 50 minutes. So do you think you can sustain that?
Wow, what, they just riff. They just go for
just
it.
Just go for it.
It's just ad lib.
You got a ranch hand to help you out, as it were.
I think we'll leave a nice radio that's, silence.
That's
there.
All I've got for you.
All the bets on. My set's on.
Oh
my.
That's pretty good. Andrew is so pleased with that.
He's really pleased with it. Let's stop this section of the show before he comes up with some more. Andrew's doing his thinking of a joke face. Which is great. Now I wish there was a webcam in here. Tom, grazie mille.
The Spanish artist Francisco Goya was a man of many brushstrokes, printmaker, painter, artist of the upper classes, and master of the macabre. And now a new exhibition sheds light on the methods and ideas of the man, described by many as the father of modern art.
That exhibition is Goya, the Witches and Old Women album at London's Cortal Gallery. Reuniting the surviving drawings from that album for the first time, it plunges the viewer into a world of witchcraft, dreams and nightmares, inviting them to delve further into the artist's vivid imagination. Joining us in the studio is the show's senior curator, Juliet Wilson-Barrow. First of all, this is an interesting thing. This is an album. This is small-scale stuff. It's in a big room. How on earth do you get people to engage with this? It's a tough one, isn't it?
I think you have to tell them that the drawings are really worth getting close to and looking at. And once you do that, even with one drawing, you're hooked. I mean, his handling is so extraordinary. They're very, very free. They're like sort of oriental calligraphy in a way. Yeah. Free black and white brush strokes, but the detail is incredible. Every glance of an eye and every toe on a foot is sort of charged with energy, and it's perfectly in place. He leaves a lot to your imagination. He lets you rebuild the picture that he puts impressionistically down, but with enough detail to absolutely rivet you and capture your attention.
Now, Juliet, we were explaining in the introduction to this piece that the collection has come together really for the first time. This was a book of drawings that has been scattered to various collections. And this is the first attempt with these sketchbooks to bring all the pictures, or as many as we know about, back together. Can you tell us how that process happened? And do you think you've got most of the images that would have been in that book in the first place?
We know that we've got all the images. There are 22 known sheets, numbered up to 23, so we know there's one missing. And by a very careful process of analysis of every single sheet, we think we have probably got the right assignments for those pages which have lost their numbers, because quite a lot of them, when they were stripped out of the book, which Goya numbered consecutively right through, always with his albums. He made 8 albums over the course of the second half of his life, and each one is on a particular kind of paper, and all except the very first one, which was a little pocket book, they're all numbered. So we know when the pages are missing, and they were widely scattered.
And the title of the exhibition and the book, Witches and Old Women. I know that it was actually called, I think, Dancing and Singing in Spanish. But what does the title refer to then?
Goya titled all the pages. Most of his albums have written titles at the bottom or sometimes at the top as well. But he never gave a title to the album as such. And a long time ago, a Goya specialist in America, Eleanor Sayre, studied all the albums, was able to kind of make a catalogue of what each one consisted of, and describing the different types of paper and their watermarks so that you could identify each one. And because they have no titles and there is a chronology, which we're still trying to work out, in fact, she gave them letters of the alphabet. So they were known as album A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. And the first two haven't changed. They're still A and B at the beginning of this album career, if you like. And the last two, which were made when he was in Bordeaux at the very end of his life, they're still G and H. But the letters mean nothing. And some of them have had sort of traditional titles like the Inquisition album, because there's a big series of drawings, horrific scenes of Inquisition and torture in Spain. So that's a peg that you can kind of hang that album on. Our album, which is album D, for one thing, has changed its place in the chronology, so the letter D made no sense at all. And it has a subject matter which is fairly consistent. There are a lot of witches, and there are a lot of old women. So when we did the big exhibition at the Hayward Gallery in 2001 with samples, selections from every album, I sort of thought, well, we better try and give them titles. And I gave that particular title to this album. It's not meant to be definitive in any way, and you can reinterpret that album in all sorts of ways, but it just is a convenient peg to identify.
And what were the albums for in the first place? Were they private for Goy? Were they just his sketchbooks, or were they designed to be shown?
No, he probably did
not designed to be shown, drawn to be shown.
Drawn to be maybe shown to friends,
right,
who were interested in his ideas and his view of the world. They certainly were private. The first major album, which we still call Album B, which was made in Madrid around 1796, moved gradually from sort of, I don't know, everyday scenes with a slightly satirical turn to them, into really outright caricature, sort of typical 18th century, almost Gilray caricature, Hogarth, all those names come to mind. And he started giving them captions. And so they turned into a series of satires. And he dropped that album at a given moment and started doing preparatory drawings for prints, because he got the idea that he would like to share this with a very wide public in the form of published prints.
And is seeing these his sort of personal albums, these sketchbooks, they're grander than sketchbooks, but they've got that feel to them, I guess. This is something which is amazing to see about Goya, presumably, because so much of his work is, as you said, he's got such a good hand, such an amazingly natural draftsman with such flair. It's nice to see the ink on paper rather than the finished painting sometimes with an artist like this, isn't it?
It's incredibly intimate when you get into the drawings. I mean, they're not sketches. They really are finished drawings, although some of them, particularly in this album, are quite rough.
I mean, I guess I'm
really
confusing
free.
The format with the finished
yes,
article.
No,
yeah.
The format is a paperback book, in a way. And it's possibly that when he was doing these sort of satirical drawings, he was in with the enlightened people in Spain, with the reformers, and he could see all the bad things that were going on. And, you know, there was censorship and the Inquisition, so he had to cover things up. In effect, in that earlier album, which leads straight into his very, very fierce criticism of social evils and the bad behaviour of monks and friars and priests generally, he was not anti-church. He was not anti-religious. I think he had a very firm Catholic faith, but he was against all the abuses of the church. I mean, things that are still topical today for one reason or another. He was really wrapped into the social fabric of his times. And with his enlightened friends, he could see ways to change this.
Juliette, obviously you know these pictures very, very well. Now you've been putting them up in the walls just this week. What ones stick in your mind when you've seen them so intimately, when you've been able to put your face just a few inches away from them? Can you give us an example of one that kind of sticks particularly in your mind?
The choice is very wide, because the subjects do vary. Some have actual subject matter. One particularly fascinating one has a subject matter that we cannot even properly read on the page. He made, as he was doing it, he got carried away by his own drawing and what was appearing on the page, and would make many, many alterations. So some of them he then overlays, overdraws, and some of them become quite difficult to decipher. One of the most amazing ones, which really floors us all, is the last drawing, the last known drawing in the album. which is a little old figure, you can't tell whether it's a man or a woman, bent over, crawling along on two sticks, with just nothing. He, she is on a blank white page and just a shadow on the ground, and is struggling along, and the caption says, just can't go any further at the age of 98, but still struggling, obviously. The words are very important. Sometimes they don't convey more than the sense of a nightmare, for example. That's a recurrent caption all through the albums. But sometimes there will be, for example, the one that I was mentioning, where you can't tell what the subject really is about, a mass of people emerging from a building. And he just says, nothing is known about this. So something very dark has been going on and is going on. They're just incredibly intriguing.
How much of it do you think, how much the content of these pictures is allegorical about what was happening in Spain? And there's quite gothic subject matter, albeit political of the time. And how much of it is metaphorical about Goya getting old, about the aging artist, do you think? Are both those things going on, or neither of those?
I think everything's going on, yes. I mean, he had been observing. I mean, people say that even the satirical drawings, when they first start, are a sort of new departure. Mm. They're not. We have one real sketchbook has emerged in fairly recent years that he made in Italy, or began in Italy. And it was a sketchbook. It's the only one that has survived over the whole first half of his life. It's the only real sketchbook known, with notes and copies after the old masters and after antique sculpture. And even in that, you can see his interest in the human figure, in people, in the way they express themselves with gesture and glance. And this goes on right through. When he goes eventually to Madrid in the mid-1770s and is contracted to paint tapestry cartoons, decorative cartoons, in effect, every one of them is filled with people doing various things. It may be no more than playing a game of pelota, but everybody is engaged in a kind of human drama, either in play or in real fighting. There's a fight at an inn among the tapestry cartoons. He addresses all the human responses to life and the struggles between people, which he experienced personally because he had a lot of trouble at court. People were very jealous of him. He was very quickly regarded as a very major artist, and he got portrait commissions. It wasn't, in fact, until his illness, which left him completely deaf in the early 1790s, that he, in a way, began to paint for himself and draw for himself. And that's when these album drawings launch. But they're taking up and expanding on themes that you can trace, if you look, you can trace it all through his work.
And how close, in the end, then, are we able to get? Can I touch my nose on the glass? When I go to the court,
yes, you're pretty well.
Well, it sounds fantastic. The show is Witches and the Old Women album. It's at the Courtauld Gallery. Juliet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Juliet Wilson-Barrow, senior curator of Goya, the Witches and Old Women album. And that exhibition opens at the Courtauld Gallery here in London on February the 26th. We have a little bit of music, Andrew, a little bit of light musical relief
to cheer us up after Goya.
Actually, this is cool. So I was messing around on various music blogs and I found this amazing new record. It's a record of Estonian psych rock, folk, jazz and sort of choral music from the 60s, and it's put together and it's called Collage, aptly enough, and the album title is 4704, which is how long it lasts, and it's the maddest thing in the world. I never knew anything like this existed. I'm going to try not to annihilate the title of it, but this is, as I said, this is a bit of psych rock stuff. There's all sorts of different stuff on this record. It's amazing. This is called Meme Vic. That was Meme Vic from the Collage album called 4704. Where'd you go?
When you want a bit of Estonian psych rock, you come to the Monocle Weekly, obviously.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
The title of our next guest's book has a spelling mistake. Well, maybe. It's Accidents Will Happen. That's accidents ending with a C, mind you. With the subtitle The Non-Pedantic Guide to English Usage, the author, Oliver Cam, argues that we're all too hung up on rules, from dangling prepositions to split infinitives, and that all the pedants are simply wrong.
Well, Oliver joins us now from The Times here in London, where he works as a columnist. Welcome to The Weekly, Oliver. First of all, you've kind of waded into a territory which is full of potential problems. People really fight about the English language and every comma and every punctuation mark. What made you feel that it was time for your book?
You're absolutely right that many, many people feel very passionately about the English language, and I am one of them. I write a weekly column on English usage for The Times, and the conundrum that presented itself to me was that a lot of my colleagues, professional journalists, and a lot of Times readers who write to me are worried about their own command of the language. And these are all people who are very intelligent, who use language very well, who are very articulate, and yet they worry that their own English is substandard. And to me, this does not compute. And what I concluded was that they have some dim recollection of rules that they might have been taught or picked up on things like split infinitives or stranded prepositions or less versus fewer, and overlook the fundamental fact of the English language, which is that those of us who use it, either as native speakers or fluent non-native speakers of English, we already know the rules of grammar, the real rules of grammar, things like word order, things like the way you change the ending of verbs for tense or case, and that the things that the pedants fuss about, split infinitives and all the rest of it, they don't matter. They're not real rules. They're not part of the grammar of standard English, and never have been. They're stylistic preferences, if at all. And I want to stress to people, stop worrying about your command of the language. Embrace the language you already speak, because you are already a master of English grammar.
I wonder, Oliver, whether you feel perhaps at the moment as well with the web and with social media and with a very much shortened way of writing and communicating, that perhaps people feel that language is running away from them because of these all these other formats of being able to communicate with each other.
Yes, I think that's a common complaint, and I don't believe it at all. If you think back to, not that we were around at the time, but if you have read about the invention of the telegraph, exactly the same complaint or exactly the same fear was expressed then. The need for compression in messages would deprive people of standards of literacy. They'd use abbreviations and other damaging things. And of course, the telegraph is perfectly consistent with literature, with books, with other forms of communication, and so is it true with the internet, with text speak, with Twitter. People adapt their use of language to the situation they're in. They adapt their written language according to what technology they're using, and they adapt their spoken language according to who they're speaking to, whether it's a loved one where you use intimate terms, or a friend where you use casual terms, or a boss where you use more formal language. We all adapt according to the situation, and the language doesn't diminish, it doesn't degenerate. It's very powerful, very vital.
Do you think, though, that what's interesting is, you know, knowing the rules allows you always to break rules in whatever part of life you think of? And I think that the funny thing about English is, you often, when you read a very creative writer, a good writer, you know that they are kind of willfully going against, you know, perceived rules,
but they're even stronger because their writing, you know, is actually oddly referencing those rules. So sometimes I wonder whether if you just say, okay, none of these rules really matter, do what you feel, that I wonder if you think at the heart of it all, it is good to have some understanding of, you know, what those rules are.
It's certainly very important to have a grasp of the conventions of standard English, not because standard English is correct and other dialects of the language are wrong, but just because standard English is a more recognisable form of the language than any non-standard variant. But that's a bit like saying English is more useful to know around the world than it is to know Danish or Welsh, because more people speak it. It doesn't mean that standard English is correct, it's just more useful. And I do think, of course, that it's important that children and adults be fluent in the conventions of standard English so that they know that it's we were rather than we was, because that's the convention of standard English. But my criticism of the pedants' case is not that they stick by rules and I say break them. Not at all. My view is that the things that they fuss about are not real rules of grammar at all and never have been. They're just superstitions that have been passed on from one generation to another and that do nothing for the quality of people's prose except clog it up. The famous example of split infinitives, an absolutely ludicrous rule that has no warrant in English grammar, this ban on split infinitives, so you're not supposed to say to boldly go, you have to say to go boldly. That's just nonsense, and it works against the fluency of people's prose. So my argument is not that the rules should be ignored. I'm saying that the real rules of grammar are things we don't get wrong, and the things that pedants obsess about are not rules of standard English and never have been. Just throw them away, you'll feel much better for it.
I wonder, Oliver, with how long you feel language has been static. I mean, you mentioned the Telegraph, you work for a newspaper, and obviously since the dawn of the BBC, I suppose there has been a way that people feel that they should be able to speak like. There's an aspiration of RP, perhaps in the accent, and Oxford English in the execution of it. Do you think that we're always looking back to the past and looking at a sort of halcyon day of spoken and written language that is kind of impossible to live up to?
Yes, you're absolutely right. In every generation, absolutely every generation, there are people who worry that standards of English are declining and that in another generation or two or three, we'll just be communicating by grunts. And some of the greatest writers in the English language, Defoe worried about this, Jonathan Swift worried about it. And 50 years after that, Dr. Johnson came along and compiled his great English dictionary. The ability to communicate fluently never, ever breaks down. And of course, there's no such thing, and to go back to your premise of this question, there's no such thing as a static version of English. English is a river. It's got many, many tributaries. It's impermanent. The way we pronounce it changes. If you listen to films even as recently as the 1950s, the dialect of English sounds quite affected by the standards of our time. Doubtless my own accent, my own dialect, probably sounds affected to some of your listeners. We're all part of the same river. We're all part of the same constant ferment of the English language. And the fact that most English speakers in the world now are non-native speakers because of the great expansion of the language in the post-war era, the language is changing all the time in ways we can't even predict. That doesn't detract from the beauty of the language. It makes it ever more fascinating.
So you referenced one of the hot topics for pedants in your introduction there. You were talking about few and less, and that's a thing that we see numerous letters still to this day on newspapers' letters pages. What's your standing on that then?
People worry that you can only use less with mass nouns, like less coal, and you must use fewer with count nouns, like fewer sacks of coal. It's a bogus rule. It was made up by an amateur grammarian in the late 18th century. People cleave to it fanatically, but in fact, if you just say what comes naturally, you won't get it wrong. It does sound a little more idiomatic to say fewer sacks of coal rather than less sacks of coal, but it doesn't sound anything other than ridiculous to say Brighton is fewer than 60 miles from London. It just sounds affected. It sounds a hypercorrection. If you say what comes naturally, you'll get it right, and that's true pretty much of the entire field of English usage. Do not be bamboozled by pedants into thinking that you're standards of English are poor, because they're not. You're a master. Both of you, your listeners, you're all masters of English grammar already without having to be taught it.
And does it come, I mean, do both these standards apply for both spoken and written English, Oliver? I mean, you're a sort of custodian of the language. Being a columnist for an august newspaper here in London, it's up to people like you to man the castle, isn't it?
You're very kind, but I don't think of myself as a custodian of the language, because the English language doesn't belong to me, doesn't belong to the Times, doesn't belong to newspapers or writers. It belongs to all of us, in the apt phrase of Steven Pinker, the cognitive scientist and linguist, where language is concerned, the lunatics are in charge of the asylum, which is to say there isn't some august body out there determining what it is. It belongs to all of us. And of course, I believe that standards of written English, they need to be fluent, they need to be communicative, they need to be arresting to the reader. And it's a different skill from speaking. Of course, when I'm talking to my friends, I don't speak in perfectly formed sentences all the time. I adapt my language according to the situation. There's really no there's no worry about standards of English. We all find a way of expressing ourselves with a full variety of expressions of meaning.
Well, it was proper good, wasn't it? Speaking to Oliver Cam there, author of the new book, Accidents Will Happen, The Non-Pedantic Guide to English Usage.
After the break, we'll catch up with a world tour of Hamlet. That's right, after this.
Every weekday at 1800 hours London time, join one of Monocle's editors and their panel of special guests for an in-depth roundtable discussion of the day's key news stories.
It's not the West or the outside, the international community trying to do something in Iraq. It's about the international community trying to support an Iraqi effort.
Fresh and passionate insight from leading international voices on global affairs, politics and business here in London.
I was in the south, in Sangin, in Helmand province. What I saw there makes me pretty confident that within a year of the troops going, the south will fall to the Taliban.
And of course, we bring you reviews of the best in film, music, theatre and literature from all around the world.
Every single character is an eccentric. It's all, oh, Bagara, she thought her husband was a potato. I'm astonished that it's on the Booker long list.
Hear the sharpest views and insights on the big issues of the day. And get up to speed on how to add to your cultural wealth as well. That's all on Midori House, Monday through Friday at 1800 hours London time.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Now, it's a theatrical adventure beyond the wildest dreams of even the most imaginative of playwrights. Take one of Shakespeare's most famous plays, take 2 years, and tour it in every country on the planet. That's the idea behind Globe to Globe Hamlet, a tour that began at Shakespeare's Globe in London last April and has so far clocked up approximately 115,000 kilometres and toured around 80 countries.
So can Shakespeare really speak to everyone? And how has Hamlet been interpreted in a host of diverse contexts? Well, a bit earlier, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Dominic Drumgoole, Artistic Director of Shakespeare's Globe and Director of Hamlet.
First of all, Hamlet, possibly, arguably, the best known of Shakespeare's plays, certainly not the only one that could be said to have universal resonance. You know, his plays have been performed all over the world for centuries and centuries and centuries. If you're going to pick one play to take on tour to every country, why Hamlet?
A couple of reasons. One, it's very well known, as you've just said. It's full of iconic plastic images, a man with a skull, a man with a knife over his stepfather, the ghost appearing. So all of those translate very well wherever you go. The other thing is that it's endlessly beautiful and endlessly mysterious and endlessly extraordinary. You could take Romeo and Juliet on the road because it's equally iconic, But after 9 months, probably the whole company would be trying to kill each other out of boredom.
For real, as opposed to just on stage.
Because it's got limitations as a play. Hamlet is sort of infinite and is sort of infinitely mysterious. So you're always learning something. I mean, you're always finding fresh things and you're always turning up surprises. And it's endlessly beautiful. So it can not only be great for the audience, but it can continually surprise and enthrall the people that are doing it, which I think was a very important factor in choosing it.
I mean, you're right in that the play and the character are very malleable. I cannot claim to be an expert, but I've seen Hamlet performed a few times. I've seen him done as a vainglorious martyr. I've seen him done as a sulky teenager. Have you found that the audiences you've played to so far, because the world tour is only about a third of the way through, are people seeing something different in Hamlet depending on where you are?
Yeah, they are. I mean, we've done 77 countries so far. I think the most extraordinary thing about him is that he's instantly translatable wherever you go, because he's always looking for his own future. He's always trying to be modern in his own time. And wherever you go, there are always people who are dissatisfied with the present and who are looking to turn it into something new and into something brighter and a bit bolder and a bit clearer. And that's what Hamlet was trying to do 400 years ago. It's what he's been continuously trying to do for 400 years. And it's what translates so easily wherever you go. Whatever moment you're in, whether in South Africa, in South America, or whether in North America, or in Europe, or in Africa, which is where we've covered so far, you've got kids who are angry and who are dissatisfied and who want to make a new future. And Hamlet is the sort of icon of that.
He's that part of all of us that thinks it's just not fair.
Yeah, and that's restless, and that thinks we should be doing better, and thinks we should be arranging things better and making a fairer and a more sensitive and a more intelligent world. I think that, you know, we try and see everything at the Globe through the perspective of when it was written, because that, I think, is the way of making it modern. That's the way of making it fresh. And all of the stuff about vainglorious martyr, as you say, or sulky teenager, most of that is complete contortion and twisting of the play. And it's a sort of post-Freudian misery that's sort of smeared across it. When it was written, he was a bright, brilliant boy, you know, and I watched a wonderful piece of old-fashioned television with on YouTube with Orson Welles and Peter O'Toole, both drinking whiskey, both smoking cigarettes, both pissed. And Orson Welles said this brilliant thing. He said, Hamlet's a genius. That's the thing about him, is that he's brilliant. He's brilliant with language. He's like a Mozart of language. He gives it away for free. And it's that sort of generosity of spirit, and it's that brightness and lightness within him that we're trying to translate as best we can. So it's not 2 years of touring a miserable, sulky teenager, which would drive everyone mad. Trying to be more generous.
I want to talk about the what must be the extraordinary logistics of this process. And I guess what I wanted to ask first was the point at which someone actually decided, seriously, we're going to do this, because the idea of playing, let's do Hamlet in every country in the world, it's an idea you have at about 10 minutes to 11, and you wake up the next morning and think, God, that'd be mad. But how did this go from back of beer mat to somebody actually say, no, seriously?
It's an idea you have when you're pretty far gone, actually, and you're on your 15th cocktail in Claridge's on that particular day. And it was an idea that came up. And what we're great at the Globe is we do things. We come up with these ideas and we do them. We invited 37 countries from all over the world to come to the Globe and present the complete works of Shakespeare in 6 weeks as part of a festival. A similarly mad idea. And we did it. We thought one night in the bar, let's read the whole Bible out. It takes 72 hours. We got 20 actors together. We did it. You know, when we want to do something, because we're a young organisation and there are no rules, we tend to do it. So almost from the moment we'd had the idea, we knew it was going to happen.
Have there been any countries you haven't been able to get into, or is anybody being especially difficult, or does everybody basically... Because I guess the other thing you do have on your side, you have Hamlet, which everybody knows, and you have the Globe Theatre, which has a brand and a calling card, is, again, universally recognised. Is anyone being difficult about it?
No. I mean, everyone's very welcoming and everyone's very enthusiastic. I mean, we have to exercise caution because we don't want to put anyone in harm's way. So in our most recent leg, we had to, with great sadness, jump Libya as we were passing over North Africa. But we very much hope that if we do that act of jumping, that we find a way within the envelope, which is 2 years, that we can pop back there and get it done there. So there are countries which we're cautious about just because at the moment, at this particular moment, it's unsafe. But we're very, very keen to get in everywhere. And by and large, everyone's insanely enthusiastic. It's such a sort of simple idea and a stupid idea in some way that it's very hard to object to.
It's one of those ideas that, because I guess of its simplicity and its and that combination with its audacity, does break down any resistance there might be. I think it sounds like a thing that people would want to be part of.
Yeah, everyone gets it, and it's a connector. You know, it connects people across a wide distance because we've been everywhere, but also in a rather wonderful way, it connects people that are very close together. We've just done the latest leg, finished with Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and then Tanzania. And moving through those countries in a coach, it's great to be able to do an event, a cultural event that coheres and that pulls all those countries together and helps them to talk to each other in some small way.
How big a company are you travelling with?
16, 4 stage managers, 12 actors, and it's a squad system. So we've got 2 Hamlets, we've got 3 Ophelias, we've got 3 Gertrudes. So every part is, there's more than 2 people that can cover it. And so in that way, we can change the team on a very regular basis, partly to keep it fresh and partly so we've always got cover.
And everybody so far is getting along okay? It hasn't turned into a Shakespearean drama of its own on the bus?
No, they're fantastic. They're amazing. They're an extraordinary group of people. They're astonishingly mature, level, clear, calm. I go out for a week, I find it overwhelming. The contrasts, the variety of experience thrown at you, the clashes of sensibility from one place to another are just sort of slightly overwhelming. And what's amazing about this group of people, who are very astonishing human beings, is how level they've remained through all of this extraordinary roller coaster of a journey.
You've been performing in some places which are not just out of the way. These are places which have absolutely no infrastructure and no experience for handling the kind of thing you're putting on. You played in Djibouti, Somaliland. I guess to narrow it down to one question, if you decide you want to perform Hamlet in Somaliland, who do you call?
Well, we were very lucky in Somaliland because they've just opened a very, very brave, very admirable, extraordinary people have just opened a new cultural centre in Hargeisa. When the power left in 92 and Somaliland declared its independence, they mined the previous theatre and they blew it up. They hadn't seen a play in Hargeisa for 23 years. Not only had they not had any visitors, they hadn't actually had the wherewithal to put their own plays on. But over the last couple of years, some very brave, very extraordinary people have created a cultural centre with a library, with an art gallery, with a small theatre of their own, and they were our hosts, extraordinary people in a society that's still sort of forming itself, and in which a lot of people are anti-literacy and they're anti-women learning and they're anti-plays and they're anti all sorts of art. Their courage in inviting us there and in creating this cultural centre is far beyond anything that we've achieved. So they were the people that brought us in, though. Unfortunately, we weren't able to perform in the theatre because it wasn't deemed safe, but they organised an extraordinary audience that came to see us in a ballroom in a sort of UN compound where we eventually did it.
You're about 80 countries down, I think I'm right in saying. Yeah. So you've got, that leaves more than 100 to go. What's coming up imminently?
Next leg is West Africa, Nigeria, Benin, and then going on further down south. We're doing the 2 Congos, we're doing Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo. That'll be a leg that's going to finish in Madrid. By the time that one finishes, we'll be halfway through in time and in number of countries. Then we bounce across to where you're from, through Australia and New Zealand. And then we're going to have an extraordinary leg doing the South Pacific Islands, doing Nauru and Tuvalu and Fiji and wherever.
Sounds dreadful.
Yes,
arduous is exactly the word. Yeah.
And then work our way back in from the east.
And I've just finally, I know this is probably an impossible question for you to answer, but of the performances you've seen so far, do you have one particular favourite?
No, no favourites. I think the great globe religion is no favourites. You know, we love everything we do equally, and we love every country we go to equally. And whether it's in Lima in a beautiful old Spanish theatre or playing to 2,000 people in a theatre in Addis Ababa built by Haile Selassie to celebrate himself, we celebrate difference. We don't create hierarchies of good, better, best.
Well, if not one particular favourite, then has there been one where you've actually just found yourself thinking, how did this happen? How did we get here?
Yeah, it's sort of every time. I mean, in Quito, in Ecuador, you know, seeing riot police out to deal with the amount of people that wanted to get in that couldn't get in.
You have to take that as a compliment.
You do. And it was a beautiful square, beautiful great big theatre with a balcony where you expected someone to come out with a rifle and shout Viva la Revolucion. And, you know, it's everywhere you go is sort of extraordinary in one way or another.
That was Dominic Drumgool, Artistic Director of Shakespeare's Globe here in London, with Monocle's Andrew Muller. And there we have it, Andrew. That is it for edition 290. What was it for?
Yes.
I've counted them all off. That's not written on the script. I know. I can remember how many we've done.
Okay.
Yeah? I'm good. You know me. I'm good with figures.
We had quite a highbrow.
Some better than others.
We've had quite a highbrow hour.
It's been good, isn't it? We haven't had our language corrected by Levacam. I think we were sort of in agreement on how language should work. We've been educated by Goya. We were saying, weren't we, isn't it wonderful to have a proper expert in as well?
She's amazing. And it's just, you know, I hadn't realised before she came in kind of what a piece of detective work it was. You know, she's kind of, you know, half curator, half Miss Marple. It's that sense of, you know, all the work that goes into pulling something like this together. And it was fascinating hearing, you know, all that, the research done, how they looked at the folios, the way the ink fell, that they could tell what order it had been in. I thought she was great.
Miss Marple or Poirot?
Well, I think she was... I like both.
Bergerac or Columbo?
Columbo. I wouldn't watch Bergerac.
No one knows what we're talking about. I think it's time to wrap this thing up. Thank you to the guys behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and Alice Bloch. And our studio manager was Claire Urban and Chris Grimes. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.